The Sunstone Foundation presents War Against the Gods, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Each of you to this session of the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium. This hour, we will be fortunate to hear from Philip L. Barlow, who will read excerpts from a novel in progress to be entitled War Against the Gods. In War Against the Gods, Mr. Barlow creates a mythological scenario of the pre-existence while articulating ideas in order to explore some of the most important issues in religion. The atonement, the meaning of Jesus Christ, human freedom, deification, and the balance of faith and doubt. Mr. Barlow was raised in Bountiful, Utah. He has a master's degree in American religious history from Harvard University and is completing his doctoral dissertation there and has done related studies on early Christianity, more specifically, conceptions of the atonement through Christian history. He is a father of two children. Mr. Barlow.
It's nice for me to get to participate in this. Can you hear back there? I have been grateful for all your thoughtful comments and reminded as I listen to these various sessions that I don't know very much about very much. So my modesty has been reinforced through this symposium, which I'm grateful for. One of the earliest gospel doctrine classes that I ever attended, the teacher invited a sister at the back of the room to articulate the two plans in the pre-existence, the plan of Satan and the plan of Christ. And she proceeded to do so, and after she had articulated the satanic plan, the teacher rhetorically asked, "Now, doesn't that sound like a great temptation? We'd all be secure, and everything would be swell." And at that point, everybody in the class yawned in unison, because we all knew that we needed our freedom. It occurred to me then and since that sort of construction or caricatured understanding doesn't really support a thoughtful belief in the real issue up there, where real intelligences really bite out of the plan, surrendered the hopes that God had for them. For that matter, could be a little bit more serious to a believing Mormon person, could actually threaten Joseph Smith's conceptions themselves because they cheapen them, make a silly caricature out of them. So I, over the years, recently have had this thing boiling in my head a little bit to try to detrivialize, if that doesn't sound arrogant, detrivialize expressions of those kind of conceptions, and believe, as a matter of fact, that they do matter. I have heard little hints of pedantry here and there throughout this symposium, but mostly humble and thoughtful doubters, strong disbelievers, and faithful persons, and I'm very sympathetic to the spirit that Carlisle Hunsaker articulated last night, that the ideas of Mormonism are great on their own terms, and we need to somehow come to fathom them on their own terms, and they hold up, and people who are getting too bent out of shape over these new letters and things as they are, it is my belief that they don't have an entire handle on the profundity of Mormon theology, pure and simple. This war against the gods, as Dottie suggested, therefore tries to talk about the war in heaven, the issues of freedom and greater means and if it's swell or not swell, and conceptions of the atonement and the final meaning of Jesus Christ. And in the course of it, I try to articulate the most profound religious doubts that I can muster argument for, as well as try to create a response for legitimate grounds for faith in response to those doubts. And I also have a kind of a small minor theme of art and the purpose of art as it relates to that. So the first, let's see, before I do that, on the inside cover of this book that's going to be called War Against the Gods is I'm going to commission an artist to do some version of something like these slides that I brought that I wanted just to show three or four of to you. And on the back inside cover of the book is going to be an image of the crucified Christ, in contrast, because the dialogue is between my Satan figure and Christ. Jay, if you could just wing those on for us. Could someone catch those lights really quickly? Thank you. This image will come to mind as I get to a certain point in this narration, and it's not a thrilling picture, but it has some shock value for a part that goes on in the story. People who are just reading through the book will be able to recall that image because it'll be on the inside cover of the book. So, Jay, you can just whiz through those four shots really quickly if you can kind of remember that. Good. Thank you. Now, the first section that I'm going to read as those lights come back on is going to be a little bit psychologically untenable because I have collapsed a considerable amount of material in which I've developed these characters into a brief thing so that you can get a running feel for the flow of narrative. And then the second section that has a little bit to do with the conversation on art, just hearing it orally, I suspect you'll be a little bit confused, and do not despair because the narrator is also confused at that point. And then I hope you'll get a feel for one. I try to climax this little passage that I'm reading that will come about in the middle of the book with Satan's declaration of war on heaven. It was from these 1,000 that 30 supreme ones were selected. The 30 were rivaled not only in princely valor and demeanor, but also in intellect and appearance. It was these who actually took part in the doings of the council, in addition to those more properly called gods. Among the official 30 who sat on the council was an unofficial but tightly allied subgroup dubbed the 9 by others of the 30. Even among the latter, these 9 stood out as particularly articulate and creative explorers of the nature of things. They were more often than not of one mind in discussions of cosmic policy and policy application. They were as well frequent comrades when not dealing in affairs of the council. Balliol was their natural leader. How shall I tell you of Balliol? I despair of success. You will think me false. Balliol defied plausibility. I would be pressed to exaggerate the scope of his influence among us. His meteoric rise to prominence was an astonishment and a legend. So lustrously and so suddenly had his fame burst upon public attention that derivatives of his name passed quickly into the common language. Hence the term Balliot, which came to denote either precocious or, as a verb, to rapidly ascend, whether in public stature or in actual physical elevation. Belucifer meant day star or bright. Similarly, the proverb, he is become Balliol, or she is Balliol to us, suggested that the person to whom the phrase was applied was a great benefactor, or had become a master at some or another skill, or, if said mockingly, that the person had grown great in his or her own eyes. Balliol was an enemy to apathy, a veritable dragon to those unzealous in good causes. His character was endlessly fascinating, the character almost of a god. He was thoroughly drenched with ability and energy and graciousness. His face and figure were exquisitely proportioned and comely. It was said with only slight hyperbole that in olden times, before his fame, when he was more often seen in public, that persons of either gender would, upon catching sight of him, stop in the midst of any errand simply to gaze. He was that striking. His wit and profound thought, coupled with his already noted appearance and his impeccable articulation, were capable of capturing audiences of any rank or number. So vast was his knowledge that I once heard the most learned of the stewards describe it as intimidating and encyclopedic. The story, in fact, is told of one of the 1,000, himself of celebrated wisdom, who, upon hearing Balliol speak, put his head in his hands in feigned despair, lamenting, "It is obscene for one spirit to know so much." Every wound Balliol discovered was mended. Every person he encountered improved. Every task he assumed became somehow more important because it was he who did it. It would almost relieve monotony if I could with accuracy recount inevitable flaws in Belial's makeup. But whatever his faults, they were well concealed, and who in heaven had ambition to expose them? Where Belial was, there was success, always. While he had few critics, I will not say he had none. One or two, for example, thought his prose rather more calculated to dazzle than to communicate, but I did not find it so. The reader will sample it presently and judge for himself, since his speeches are now canon for historians, and abridgments find place in this record. Kara, I forgot to tell you about Kara. Kara's sort of my fantasy woman up there in the pre-existence, and she's kind of Abel, who is the narrator's tutor. Kara, of all people, once privately observed to me that Belial seemed very easily to accept the fuss that unvaryingly was made of him as simply his natural due. I forgave her this oblique envy without further thought, for she too had few faults, and it was reassuring now and then to find her short of perfection. My own opinion was that the acclaim that ever surrounded Belial was, in fact, his natural due. What is more, public adulation was inevitable. It would have been coy of him to attempt to deflect it. Besides, if fame forced upon Belial a clear sense of his extraordinary talents, it could never be supposed that he did not make every effort to use those talents in the service of the realm. Indeed, his legacies were great and many. He contributed both philosophically and technologically, and in some ways altered the very style of heaven. It was Belial, for instance, who first, and then I give some of his technological first that I need to cut for our purposes here. The people as a whole soon took these improvements as granted facts of their lives. As rapidly as their novelty gave way, people no longer attached the benefits of their use to the glory of their inventor in any conscious way. That Belial remained great in their eyes goes without saying, but few at any given point in time could have articulated how thoroughly he had touched every one of their lives. It was actually, however, as a philosophic explorer that Belial's star shone most brightly in the public sky. It was he who had coined the phrase moral aesthetics, which had become such a catchword among the stewards by the time I joined their ranks. He succeeded in getting many to understand conscience as a tool rather than as a burden. You are damned, he maintained, so long as you conceive of either the demands of conscience or commands from on high as hardships to be endured until a reward is proffered. You are restrained, manacled by such conceptions. Your progress is arrested. You must instead think of these statements or commandments as concise, invaluable expressions of efficiency. They are the keys to compatibility with the universe. Do not endure, but cherish them. As the eye gives access to the play of light, he was fond of saying, so conscience apprehends moral beauty. Treasure your conscience above your eyes. What he taught was not always so sermonic, but even when it was, it never struck us as mawkish, coming as it did from Belial. Those who gave him heed were made better. Belial's elevation to the council, although precipitous, surprised few. Yet he was the only one so dignified who had not first spent eons in the ranks of the stewards and the thousand. He had, in fact, been invited to the council almost directly from his stewardship and was only colleague to the thousand for an abbreviated tenure. Even among the gods and all but gods of the council, Belial immediately held his own and quickly achieved prominence. It was shortly after his ascent to the council that I made his personal acquaintance. Just why Belial adopted me as confidant was never entirely clear to me. Perhaps he only needed an obscure ear on which to sound his private meditations. It was distinctly flattering to discover that he was even aware of my existence. One day I was summoned to his presence by Cain, his chief attendant. The summons was a complete surprise and left me exhilarated and nervous. Cain escorted me courteously to Belial's chambers. These were adjacent to the court of the Hall of Gods, where the council was known to assemble. This structure inspired reverence in all who passed because of its function and uncomplicated elegance. Upon our arrival, a spirit greeted us cordially and provided us comfort while we awaited entry to Belial. Cain offered companionship until I was admitted, but I declined, preferring to be alone with my thoughts. I did not wait long. I had expected to be called presently into the space that Belial occupied, but it was he who came to me. When he entered the antechamber where I paced, I had no doubt that this was Belial, the prince, a son of the morning. His presence filled the room. I had seen his image many times before, of course. He was a favorite subject of the artists. Is this thing blowing in your ears? It's blowing in my ears. He was a favorite subject of the artists. He was, by my standards, an accomplished artist himself, though he laughed at the suggestion. I had prepared myself for the inevitable letdown I would feel when I encountered the unromanticized reality of his person, but his portraits paled beside the actual Balliol. I remember thinking as he approached, art could not idealize that figure. He wore the simple attire common to those of his rank, a colorless, seamless robe that was exquisitely cut, without surplus ornament. The robe was decor for the man and not the converse. I could detect in his manner no trace of ostentation. His perfect form moved with perfect grace. He does not walk, he flows, I thought. He drew near and bowed slightly, a favor I returned. His face bore a pleasant but thoughtful expression, not quite a smile. As it was customary not to address one of the great ones until first being addressed, I remained silent. To my surprise, Balliol did also. In fact, he did not speak for several moments, but communicated instead without words. His eyes told mine that I was welcome there, that there would be candor and trust between us, and no triviality. Still in silence, Balliol surveyed my soul, appraising me steadily and utterly. I yielded to his gaze. I sensed that I was naked before him, my character read like a document. My faults and strengths once exposed, I then felt Balliol accept them as facts, neither praising nor condemning, but simply comprehending them. Even in silence, Balliol's charisma was an almost physical force, a subtle wind blowing ever in his direction. When finally he spoke, much had passed between us. You do me honor to have come. I am in your debt. Balliol's voice was resonant. It was full of the quiet confidence that is the luxury of those to whom self-doubt is foreign. His smile increased slightly, but the thoughtful look remained. He gestured downward, and I sat. Balliol reclined nearby. I have been watching you, Abel, watching for some time. I might have been flattered by this declaration, or I might have been frightened, but I was only puzzled. Sir? I have been aware of you, and I am pleased by what I have seen. I want to be your friend. Much gratitude, I murmured, searching for an intelligent reply. You are a friend to all heaven. And you are too generous. But I wish to be your particular friend. I want to talk with you. Will you come and see me often? I would be honored and pleased, of course, I said, my tones reduced almost to whispers. But I am not certain I understand. You do not understand friendship? He teased. Then I shall give you lessons. Balliol's smile was now pronounced and warm. Let us learn from and enjoy one another. I am pressed by duties just now, but I desire that we converse frequently. Would that please you, Abel? I was thrilled and confused, embarrassed by my embarrassment. Embarrassed by my embarrassment. It would be very nice for me, I managed. It would be wonderful. Exasperated at my own banality, I said no more. Then you will come again when we have more leisure, Balliol said. He stood. Taking pity on my abashed state, he added, There is great majesty and calmness, don't you think? Let us speak of that when you return. I shall anticipate your visit with pleasure. He put his arm through mine and escorted me to exit. He did not speak again, but gave me farewell with the finer language of his eyes. I departed his quarters entranced. And then Balliol fails to call on him for a while, and he frets like a man in love. He's infatuated with this Balliol and anxious to meet with him again, and he doesn't for a while, and paces and all of that sort of thing. But eventually he is called called again by Cain, Balliol's chief attendant, and they do have occasional visits, and those are kind of philosophical dialogues on miscellaneous topics that are the author's pet peeves in the world. So we've skipped a little bit. In the interim, I should make clear the plans for the earth have been announced, and the sons and daughters of God have shouted for joy. And Belial, it's been clear with other hints in the narrative, has been brooding about the proposition of creating the planet Earth. My exchanges with Belial became the highlight of my existence. I craved his company and grew disconsolate when Cain did not summon me to him for long periods. Sometimes, though, our talks perplexed me. Belial was unabashedly mysterious and often made remarks calculated only to baffle. I have already noted that Belial, though he scoffed at the idea, was in fact an accomplished artist. As a thespian in his early period, he had hardly been able to go to the drama forum without dominating the outcome of each scene. As a sculptor in more recent time, he had pioneered a form of living sculpture, wherein his figures seemed somehow to assume the emotions of the onlooker, or appeared actually to be alive with subtle movement. 9 of his living statues still adorned the eastern entrance to the Edenic Gardens. His personal residence displayed a great number of his pieces, each with its own peculiar intrigue. Once, when Belial was delayed in meeting me as scheduled, I busied myself in his quarters by looking carefully at his works. I liked certain of them a great deal better than others. Some amused and some bemused me. But my dominant reaction was awe at Belial's artistic breadth. I found it incredible that such diversity of style and intent could emerge from a single creator. When finally Belial returned to his chambers, his countenance somewhat alarmed me. His face showed no residue of its customary half-smile, and his color was a rare, sullen gray. "My apologies, Abel, for keeping you waiting. I have been detained. Are you bored?" "It is no matter, sir. In your absence, I have studied your art." He nodded in appreciation, but his color remained constant and his mind remained elsewhere. I attempted to cheer him with chattered pleasantries, but without success. "I will return another time," I offered. "You are busy." "No, Abel, do stay. I want your company just now." "Of course." Belial did not speak again, however, but brooded and paced. No doubt council affairs weighed upon him. I returned my attention to his art. Presently I spied a small object, perhaps the size of my fist, constructed of foreign material that I did not recognize. The form was dark. This is the part that may not be easy to catch all orally, so hang in there. I spied a small object, perhaps the size of my fist, constructed of foreign material I did not recognize. The form was dark, almost black, and vaguely spherical. I call it a form and spherical, but to attempt its description is vanity. It was rather without form and void. The piece was not so much beautiful as it was fascinating, even disconcerting. I lifted it for scrutiny. I could not guess what it represented. "This does not resemble anything," I mused. "It looks only like chaos, or more accurately, like potentiality, waiting to happen." I wished not to offend Belial, however, and as he was so adept at reading my thoughts, I quickly repressed them and replaced the form on its stand. I moved to others of Belial's works, but the curious, nondescript piece kept recalling my interest. At length, irrepressibly intrigued, I returned to the support on which it lay, lifting and contemplating it again. I dared not ask of Belial, "What is this?" For I had made that error with other artist friends and was now an initiate of that elite circle who knew better than to inquire. I could not restrain myself, however, and so, still holding the object, I posed my question thus: "Why does this exist?" Now, I must parenthetically observe that Belial's conversational habits were distinctive. In serious matters, he generally treated others' comments or questions in one of two ways. Either he reacted with such swift sureness as to suggest that he had already anticipated and dismissed of the proffered remark, or else he prefaced his response with an exaggerated silence as though to expunge any trace of superficiality. Both techniques, I discovered, inspired caution in those with whom he spoke. I learned to think carefully before addressing Belial. When first I queried him with, "Why does this exist?" he started and looked at me quizzically. I was fearful that I had erred in asking. But he was silent a while, and I momentarily basked in satisfaction at having induced his earnest thought. However, his silence grew abnormally long, and I became embarrassed. I contemplated my vanity in intruding upon his thoughts when he was so obviously preoccupied with council matters. Why was I invariably so rash? Vanity, vanity. Yet a pensive brown and then a kinetic red invaded the gloom of his gray. Balliol's mind was in labor, soon to give birth to new thoughts. I put down the formless form and turned to another ornament, careful to do so without comment. Balliol glided across the room, raised what I had discarded, and held it above his head while murmuring an indistinct chant. Thy sun shall be darkened, thy moon will not give its light, or something equally incomprehensible. To my astonishment, the piece responded to the touch and word of its creator, becoming instantly ocean blue and more definitely spherical. Balliol rotated the globe with his deft, caressing fingers. With awe, he continued to contemplate that which he had made. This was an act of vanity without guilt, however, for what he had made seemed worthy of even his wonder. What can be shown cannot be said, he finally whispered in reverential tones. No more gray hung about his person. I beg your pardon, sir? I said, what can be shown cannot be said. It is the answer to your question and mine. I had by this time almost forgotten my question, and I was unaware that he had been asking one. I scurried to keep pace with his thoughts, but this too was vanity. Balliol was by this time exultant. Abel, I bless the day we met. You have done me great service today. You have done all heaven service. My response was ineloquent. Huh? You ask, why does this exist? But it does not. It will not. It cannot. And I will see to it. What can be shown cannot be said. I had nothing to say to this and said precisely that. But Balliol's thoughts raced on. You are an inspiration, Abel, and you shall have your reward. But I must treat you rudely again. I am away. There is so much to do. Forgive me. I shall send for you. And with that farewell, he was gone, leaving me bewildered. Well, Balliol disappears for some time, and that would have caused a sensation in heaven, except that everybody was chattering about the prospects of the new planet Earth that they had all shouted for joy about. Abel, the narrator, gets lonely again because Balliol has disappeared without any more explanation than you have just heard. And indeed, Abel never visits his quarters again. And he goes through his lovesickness stuff again. And so lots more happens. And then Balliol shows up again and surprises Abel later on. So they've had a short conversation or two. And after this renewed meeting, we're picking up again. Balliol declined to detail his meaning, but promised without my asking that we would speak again when we were not prevented by our duties from conversing at length. As it turned out, I did not speak with him again for a very long time. Members of the council had long been finding progressively less leisure. Shortly after my encounter with Balliol, the council withdrew into an unprecedented, protracted session. Neither Balliol nor any other member of the council was heard from for a great while. Even the thousand were scarcely visible and seemed, when glimpsed, preoccupied. There was a general and growing awareness that this extraordinary state of affairs was linked in some way to the plans for the new life, and speculation flourished on all levels, even among the stewards, that the world was to be inhabited sooner or later than we had assumed. Stay there. Others wondered who would be among the first to go and whether it mattered. Would a physical species be gradually developed that could eventually harbor a higher intelligence? How would the spirits be introduced into flesh? Was this birth, of which we had been told, fun? These and a thousand similar thoughts were the topics of the time. The council, we supposed, must necessarily be engaged in such affairs. I stayed aloof from these queries as best I could and was in any case occupied with other thoughts. I was one of very few outside the thousand who knew there to be dissension within the council, and the fact of this dissension was of itself a reality so monumental as to shape all else. Disharmony had simply never before occurred. Also, I wondered what I was to understand by Belial's dark comments when I had last seen him. His agitation about the risks associated with the New World discomfited me and undoubtedly was connected to the unpleasantly novel situation within the Council. These facts tainted all my thoughts about the New World, and I found myself unanxious to participate in the eager speculations all about me. I wished for a while to forget about the new life. I wished to speak again with Belial. I wished to rediscover the calm I had known prior to the late commotion. Belial I finally found, or rather, he found me. Calm was more elusive. Cain, his attendant, appears to him later on. Cain, a happy chance. I was thinking of you shortly ago. Where do you travel? Not chance at all, my friend. I travel to you. He drew near and embraced me with customary warmth. I am flattered. How may I serve you? Cain smiled. My always willing Abel. But my errand is not official business of the council. I have only arrived to fetch you, if you will come, to a meeting of some friends. Belial desires your presence. I am pleased, of course, to accompany you where you will. But what friends? And what is the purpose of our meeting? If you accept my invitation, let us walk as we speak. Do not be anxious, Abel. All will be well. Yet the cause is urgent, and the meeting now. You will recognize some present, I think, and will come to know others soon enough. Matters that concern you will be discussed, but are to be addressed only in the gathering. Until then, let us speak of other things. This we proceeded to do, and despite my intrigue with the nature of our meeting, I managed to keep pace with Cain's rapid narrative of other things, and even managed an occasional comment of my own. Cain deftly guided us through byways that I did not know to our destination. It was certain that he had been there before, but I was lost. I found myself in a remarkable amphitheater, unfamiliar but comfortable, that managed to give me the impression that I was at once both in and out of doors. Within were hundreds of persons at various stages in the process of assembling. No one held general attention. The drone of dozens of conversations filled my head. I at once recognized several illustrious figures with whom I had never before spoken and knew only by reputation. Sons of the morning were well represented, as were daughters of light. A great many of the thousand were there. Most or all of the nine were as well as additional members of the council. There were numbers of the great and noble that I did not recognize at all. Many more who were present I took to be, like myself, of less public stature. Belial, with others of the nine, sat or reclined at the extreme end of the room and seemed finally in charge of the meeting. At length, Belial and another arose, drawing attention merely by doing so. The drone dissipated. It was Belial that spoke. I'm not very good at monologues, sorry. Friends and colleagues, welcome. You are bid come at a moment of grave need, and your presence is gracious and well noted. You are selected because of our great esteem for you and because of your official or natural influence with the people. You will allow that forced haste rendered our invitations to you abrupt, though I hope not rude. I trust that your arrival here, however inconvenient, will cause you no regret. I am asked to be voice this day to concerns that will shortly affect us all. Know assuredly that my voice is not my voice alone. My voice indeed is legion, for we are many. My words are those of the ordinary, the words of the thousands and millions with whom you associate in your regular affairs. If you will allow it, do not take offense. You may find that my voice is yours. Tolerate, therefore, my tongue's rude speech. The urgency of the moment presses. It is not a time for fine oratory, but for understanding and decision. I anticipate a measure of resistance to my thoughts, for neither you nor I are accustomed to a Congress that proposes action independently of, indeed, as I shall shock you into knowing, contrary to the will of the council. But hear me through your shock, if shocked you are. All is at stake. There was an unusual gravity in Belial's voice that injected his words with extraordinary urgency. Yet he maintained a characteristic reserve and dignity that sponsored in me a confidence despite my apprehensions. He continued, Of the newly proposed world you have heard much in recent time, and I dare guess that it is no secret from this audience that there have arisen cares within the council concerning it. That the new world was to be the focus of our meeting was now explicit. This announcement seemed to surprise no one, and there were knowing nods among Balliol's audience. I, too, was not surprised and admitted to myself that I had earlier feigned ignorance to Cain and to myself. Those cares are not without foundation, Balliol went on. I am perhaps not too bold in suggesting that I speak for my colleagues in the council by observing that we have thought of little besides the new world for quite some time. Neither in solitude nor in company have I been able for a moment to rid my mind of the matter. I shall confess to you immediately that my enthusiasm for this new world was once as boundless as seems currently the case among so many others. Many of the most important others were, of course, present, and Balliol glanced about the room, engaging their eyes. I am enthused no longer. I have had a dream and a vision, a nightmare. I am haunted without respite, and I have since learned that my nightmare is a reality, or rather may become so. My fervor for the brave new world is aborted. I am come to tell you why. Balliol paused as though to draw especial attention to that which followed, but attention had been perfect since his greeting and could hardly be increased. He continued in measured, deliberate tones. The proposed world order is based on a lie. It is a cheat. It is not viable. Balliol stared straight ahead, straight before him, as if entranced with his own words. Perhaps he expected a clamor and was only determined to maintain an expressionless calm. But the silence produced in his audience by his assertion was thunderous. My own numbness was immediate and nearly complete. I was initially uncertain that I had heard correctly. My urge to leave, my urge was to leave the scene of this blasphemy, but my body was leaden and did not respond. I then thought to cry out, but no sound emerged. Those about me seemed similarly dumbfounded. I later reflected that we were momentarily in a condition of group trauma and were therefore literally disabled. After interminable moments, the calmest among us recovered. A woman immediately to my left arose and addressed the source of our astonishment. The sound of her voice helped dispel my stupor. She spoke to Balliol with deference, but managed to voice the barely utterable query. Do you put the gods on trial, Balliol? The highest has proposed a plan. The council gives assent. The council would not lie. Balliol, of course, anticipated the remark and remained unruffled, though his eyes narrowed and his speech became more rapid. Hear me, friends, without interruption, he said. Questions may come as we have time, but hear me now. The council, you say, has given assent to a plan. Pardon a correction. The statement wants amendment. The majority of the council assents to the plan. Others withhold it. I am among them. As you live and think, listen. Let me tell you of the coming world of which you are so fond. The world to be is drenched in blood, the life juice of the body scheduled to inhabit it. It reeks with the stench of mortal wretchedness. It groans with the weight of human deprivation and cries for release from its burden. Nay, it begs never to be formed. You have been told of a world of opportunity and experience and growth where fit and good discern from evil. I know of another world where evil swirls unchecked. This world is evil. Utterly. And it is evil not merely because wicked things will happen there, though the wickedness to come you cannot fathom. It is evil because even the good enacted thereon is predicated upon an evil premise. Hear me and hearken. I have seen this earth in vision, though I would almost that I had not. Its grotesque shadow is frozen in the belly of my soul. I cannot digest it. Let me regurgitate its image, lest you and I partake of its reality and sicken. His speech was rushed now, the speaker flushed and carried away with the horror of his vision. this earthly plan, or one much like it, has been attempted prior to now. This you were not told, but I have searched the records. The risks that once so troubled me concerning a world framed on human freedom are not, I have since learned, risks at all. No, they are certainties. I have beheld it. Other worlds long since destroyed have run this course before. This is indeed how the gods attained their station. But the misery left in their wake, who can tell it? Who can know it? Who can sum the anguish? Not I am sure. I cannot even grasp a single thread in the fabric of the suffering that will derive from a world where human freedom rages, disconnected from the heavens. The very thought outflanks my mind, and what morsel of this chaos I do comprehend, I cannot convey to you. But let me try an instance. Behold a scene from planet Earth, then multiply woe by infinity, and you shall have your sum. Yes, a single instance will be best, two or three at most. It is perhaps a matter of less is more, for if I tell you more, and there is so much more, your soul will numb, you will not hear. Listen, therefore, now, hear a single case. And then he gives a case that I shall spare you right now in this context, but it has to do with the abuse of a beautiful young girl. So after he does that, you will certainly accuse me of sensationalizing my narrative, but it is not so. I could, in truth, tell you worse, but it is unnecessary and repellent. The single case I have marshaled is sufficient for my purpose. Now then, imagine yourselves on the council. Imagine that you are structuring a plot to exalt the intelligence of the universe with the object of increasing their happiness and capacity, indeed with the ultimate goal that those who are willing might forsake themselves and partake of the divine nature. You are, in short, attempting to foster the great metamorphosis. Imagine, too, that to do so makes inevitable the torture unto death of only one tiny and innocent creature, my girl child, for instance. Answer, I challenge you. If the entire enterprise of making the gods were necessarily founded upon the bloody and unavenged tears of one little innocent, would you consent to engineer the plan? Would you participate? Tell me truly. I glanced about me at the audience. Many heads were raised, unable to remove their gaze from the speaker. Other heads were bowed. I bowed my own. A chill grew in my bosom, but I could not answer the question. Hear me clearly, and do not mistake, said Belial. I do not relish my role. But my stance is sound, and I will not yield. Be certain you understand me. If the spirits are to progress, they must prove themselves. They must experience existence apart from heaven's guarantees. They must know the freedom of existential independence with memory of life here all but obliterated. This the council knows. It has therefore accepted the proposal of a temporal world whose manufacture would answer these conditions. But the council does not seem to grasp the corollaries to this morally free world. The council errs. Its members are too generous. They have overestimated the development of our race. They have miscalculated our nature, as will be manifest to our calamity in temporal life. In their benevolent ambition to exalt us, the council will grant to our human selves the gift of free choice. But mortals are not gods, and the freedom that is celebrated among the gods will prove a burden and a curse to humans. They will not endure its weight. The mere agony of choosing will be almost too much for them. Yet, moreover, this too will occur on Earth. Where there is human freedom, there will be gross inequality. And where there is inequality, the strong will more often than not neglect or oppress the weak. One result will be my trampled girl child, beating her breast with her tiny fist, begging her unresponding God for a merciful death in order to escape her fate, a fate that will derive from other persons' use of freedom. The mutilated child has become the ladder of the gods. Climb to glory on her back, if you dare. The speaker's face was now transparently defiant. He paused a long moment, inviting a challenge to his words. But no one spoke. The near silence maintained by his audience throughout the speech had changed only in tenor, evolving from an initial expectancy to a final, numbing astonishment. "Well then," Balliol concluded, "I make an end. Is it necessary to make explicit that this baby represents 10 million like her? Must it be I who informs you that under conditions of a fallen world, half the population is not likely even to attain mortal maturity? The corruption of each generation will be contagious, thus tainting their heirs. Oh, the shadows I have seen. How can I tell it? Behold, the humans are without affection, and they hate their own blood. I have seen souls selling poison for gain to their siblings, crushing those who object. Conscious war I have seen and pillaged by the victors, terror and famine and grief." Pretty pictures, are they not? And how will the victims of these scenes honor the God who so stoically presides over them? Who will believe in such a being, or believing, who will worship him? He will be indicted, this God, and put to open shame. It is not I, you see, but his human subjects that will bring God to court. He will be weighed in the balance and found wanting, dismissed as non-existent or as unaccountably absent from the world. He is not at all the sort of God that they will want. Perhaps he will be loathed as a malevolent deity who relishes such suffering as they know. More likely, he will be ignored as irrelevant, an ineffectual and impotent God, victimized by his own world gone mad. The God of such an earth as I have seen will not long sustain faith, and the world, lacking faith, will not long sustain itself. It will die a violent death. It will... Enough, Balliol. It was my own voice I heard blurting, and I stood before I thought. It is sufficient. A single instance and more you have given. Desolation and wretchedness. But what is your object? What does it mean? Balliol smiled a smile that might have been a grimace, but he was finally silent. His companion, who had flanked him throughout his speech, responded in his stead. "The morrow will bring a general assembly," she informed, "called by the council itself. The new world will be further explained. But you have been here and have heard what you have heard. You cannot assent to the plan." I was mute for a long moment, uncomprehending. "But that," I stammered, and then tried again, "that would be rebellion, theomachy." "It would be, in fact, salvation," she said with steady, unflinching resolve. "The council will not organize the planet without the consent of the people. The people, in turn, will be moved by your thoughts. Thus you see your task." "You ask that we counter the council," said one. "How can that be?" "How can it help but be?" she fired. "Do you doubt what Balliol describes?" "We doubt neither Balliol nor the council," said I, "but these are now contraries." "Go home now and think," the woman commanded. She spoke in imperative tones. "Ponder hard and ponder well what you have this hour heard. The welfare of the universe hangs upon your wisdom. We are adjourned." I stood to depart, but quickly thought better of it and sat again. There was rapid movement all about me, a confusion of motion that mirrored that inside my head. Dozens already surrounded Balliol and his companions, engaging them in talk that appeared as though it might endure indefinitely. Dazed and exhausted, I yearned absurdly for both companionship and solitude. While others talked or left, I remained in catatonic posture for how long I do not know. Presently, I espied Kara walking swiftly to exit. Upon seeing one with whom I could converse unguardedly in these circumstances, I was suddenly joyful to the point of giddiness. I rapidly drew near her and touched her shoulder from behind. "Kara, had I known of your presence here, I should have gained some solace. Come, we must talk. Oh, Balliol's scenes. I wonder what you..." But Kara turned from me with one arm raised, freezing my impetuous advance. Her eyes were full of storm, and her features dark with a brooding that was novel to her face. She turned from me and walked again, vowing icily before she left, "I will refuse to be comforted." And then this last short section, just a couple of pages, brings about the morrow, and a general assembly, another general assembly, was in fact called, and the world was further explained. And Michael, who's the chief spokesman for the council, is giving a speech saying, yeah, we know there will be suffering there, and stuff like that. And we are picking up the very end of his speech where he is interrupted. So Michael says, "It is certain that such freedom will result not only in joy and growth, but also in sorrows, genuine sorrows that will..." But Michael did not finish his thought. With no warning and no precedent, heaven's dignity was gored by an unheavenly screech. An echoing, crescendoing cacophony filled all space. Of a sudden, Belial arose, shuddering and facing Michael. In the same instant, an unspeakably grotesque specter, thrice life-size, took shape before and above where Michael had addressed us. That you're supposed to, those of you who were here for the beginning, remember that image that will be in the book. Simultaneously and conjointly, a sepulchral wailing plaint escaped the throats of Belial and this phantom, rending the air and our souls, orchestrating heaven to a unison gasp. The wail intensified, louder and louder, until every spirit stopped his ears with his palms. Was ever a nightmare so ghastly as the exquisite shrieking of this duet? God forbid. We afterwards reckoned that at the inception of that sound, heaven ceased to be heaven, at least as we had known it. The only conceivable rival to this audible hell was the visual image of Belial, his features contorted to caricature by agonized rage, flanking his accursed, oversized mannequin. The noise emerging from Belial's throat mutated from rasping screams to woeful grunts, and from grunts to sibilation. Turning from Michael to his audience, he extended his arm and arched his finger toward the wretched wraith. "What can be shown cannot be said. Behold your coming sorrows." Belial's prophetic, pointing finger did not divert from its ghostly target, and all eyes not already on the image passed from Belial to it. The specter itself was obscenity embodied. Its limbs were impaled with cankered spikes, its hands and feet thereby attached to perpendicular crossbeams constructed of a heavy-looking material that I did not recognize. Upon this hideous support system, the emaciated bones that constituted the man, for it appeared to be a man, writhed without ceasing, its shrieks now muted to moans. Though all but fleshless, these bones found periodic strength to pull themselves vertically up from their original squatting posture as though to rest, so that the ever outstretched arms, previously angling above the shoulders and head, were then at nearly right angles to the body's unclothed torso. I could not guess by what esoteric technology the figure had been fabricated. It did not until afterwards occur to my beleaguered mind that this was Belial's masterwork, living art nonpareil, the cause and product of his recent self-imposed quarantine. But I was wrenched from my shock by a new and horrid thought. Belial had told me that I was the inspiration for his sculpture. I looked more closely at his creation and sickened. The specter wore my face. The thing that he had made was me. Belial's taunts continued to punctuate his groans, his accusing finger still trained on his anguished creation. "Witness the planet Earth," he shrilled. "Behold the fate that comes. Let the aspiring goddess beware. Unknown travail is hers. Let he who would be mighty obtain with open eyes." A good many in the audience had buried their heads in defense against this assault on their senses. Others had joined in Stygian chorus with Belial and his wraith, whining and moaning along in bizarre harmony. But the mass of the population was stunned so far beyond hysteria that they had to this point sat in dumb silence. They began to recover themselves, however, and showed increasing signs of tumult. Even I, who had attended Belial's meeting of friends the previous day, was ill-prepared for this scene. My thoughts collapsed in disarray. I knew not how to act. The tumult grew, but was held to a simmer by Michael, who raised his arm for attention. "Be calm," he commanded, and some obeyed. A measure of peace obtained. But Belial, ceasing his cries and relaxing his finger for the first time, contemptuously mimicked Michael. "Be calm indeed, my friends, be calm. This image, your future, should above all calm you." The spectral bones roared in pain and the turmoil broke out afresh, this time in buzzing, throbbing spasms that waved throughout the crowds. Michael's arm rose again and the din eventually subsided, or sufficiently so to hear him. He spoke nothing to us but turned now to his foe, for such had Belial become. "You are in rebellion, Belial. Your actions declare theomachy," which means war against the gods. "Your actions declare theomachy. Will you recant even now?" "Recant?" Belial scoffed. "Do you judge me a fool? You do err to think me impetuous. The gods are stubborn. They will make this earth. Yet my specter is nonetheless real. Do you deny its truth?" "No, I know that you do not. You know of it better than I. If mortals are chained to the threatened freedom, then such agony as this will be theirs. My image is truth itself. Therefore, O Michael, let it be told on earth as it is in heaven. If the image be true, then the options for us are only three: theomachy, theodicy, or slavery. Either the gods must be resisted, or their ways must be justified to spirits and men, or else subjugation is our fate, unquestioning subjugation to unspeakable conditions, like blind and stupid brutes. But this last I cannot countenance, and the second does not exist. The choice, you see, is therefore made. Let us wage war, theomachy. Or do you deny my image?" Michael began a speech, but Belial cut him short. "Deny the image, Michael," he shouted. "Deny that it is real. Deny that the minds and bodies of humans will undergo such torture. Deny it before these people. Deny it if you dare." Michael held his peace. An expectant hush fell upon all spirits. Indeed, by some principle of psychological physics, all of the kinetic energy of a population that only moments ago was on the verge of riot was momentarily converted to an ominous potential force. Everyone strained to hear. As I anticipated Michael's answer, I felt compressed in my breast the intense but leashed power of a huge, tightly wound coil. The only motion about me was that of Belial's towering ghost, writhing noiselessly now above us. Michael's voice, when finally he spoke, was grave yet stoic, surprisingly controlled and even. I could not gauge whether this revealed in him incredible composure or cosmic frigidity. "I do not deny your image," he said. That's all.